Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in the American West, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Ryan Driscoll Tate, and our guest today is David Vail. He's an assistant professor of history at the University of Nebraska at Kearney, and he's the author of Chemical Lands, a book about pesticides and aerial spraying in the North American grasslands. The book's out now through the University of Alabama. David Vail, welcome to the show.
Thank you for hosting me.
So David, why don't you start by telling us a little bit about yourself and how you became a historian?
Sure. I really enjoyed history all the way back into junior high school. And so for me, becoming a historian was one of these lifelong goals that we all sort of have when we're young. And fortunately for me, I sort of found my way with it. I grew up in Oregon, and so every degree sort of brought me eastward. And so I ended up getting my PhD at Kansas State University in 2012. Spent some time doing public history work and archives work, although I specialize in environmental history and history of science and technology and that sort of thing. And ultimately found myself at University of Nebraska at Kearney, where I could really explore some of these themes that we'll be talking about in terms of chemical lands. But really, I mean, if I think about how I became a historian, it has a lot to do with connections, most interestingly about, you know, landscapes and environment and technology. And so as I think back on this question, actually, it's really curious to see how all those pieces come together in my own professional career, not just in my scholarship.
Yeah, yeah. So why don't we start with how you came to write this book, Chemical Lands? Where did the idea come from?
Yeah. So as a master's student at Utah State, I started really thinking about how the relationships between environment, technology, agricultural science, agricultural landscapes, but specifically like extension science and that sort of stuff that we see at land grants, outside of land grant, Utah State, how that all kind of came together in a place. And so I got accepted into Kansas State's PhD program in 2006 and really wanted to keep exploring those intersections. And so as most listeners probably know, you know, you have an advisor or you have someone important in your life that sort of says, hey, I really like these ideas. Have you ever considered these remote archives in this one box that I know in the local archives or special collections? And so that's basically the conversation I had with my advisor at Kansas State. He had said, hey, you know, there are all of these archival collections at the Kansas Historical Society in Topeka, Kansas, that have to do with pesticides. And it strikes me that, you know, these intersections of environment and agriculture and science and technology, right? Like those things will all sort of reveal something new, but no one's really looked at these archives to check. So I was on my way. And so really, the genesis of Chemical Lands started as a dissertation project. And part of it is the more I got into it, as most of these projects sort of go, the more you realize, like, you know, wow, no one's really looked at these interactions here. And then that's how I kind of got onto agricultural aviation, the history of aerial spraying, which is that you see, if you drive around the Great Plains, you'll see ag planes in the sky. And you sort of, so I started making those connections. And so that's really the genesis of the project.
So could you situate the book for us? We're in the grasslands, but what regions and states are we talking about here?
Yeah, well, this is a controversial question, strangely, for people who live out here, whether or not it's the Great Plains or the Midwest or the grasslands. I sort of employ all of those concepts to an extent in the work, just because I have sort of a line in there in the note on region where it talks about how, you know, the practitioners that I'm looking at and the noxious weeds, right, they didn't have these designations. But yeah, I would say, you know, Nebraska, Kansas, Oklahoma, Texas, the Dakotas, you can connect to parts of Colorado and the High Plains, Montana. Also, Iowa gets some focus in there. And so traditionally, like the Census Bureau would consider technically Iowa to be part of the Midwest and not the Great Plains. But really what I'm trying to, I guess, talk about in terms of region, which I think is really important to understand in the histories that we write, is I would call this the Great Plains West. That's another way of kind of organizing the region. But for me, part of the book is how important is region in this story, right? Like what's going on here and does region matter? And of course, I argue that it does.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I want to touch on the fact that you opened the book with Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, which was published in 1962, and her commentary on pesticides and agricultural chemicals. So for our listeners who might not be familiar, first of all, what did Carson have to say? And second, I mean, how does it relate to the book?
Yeah, Rachel Carson is one of the stalwarts in the political debates around the application of pesticides and really the larger scope of ecological science. And ultimately, she becomes an important figure in sparking the environmental movement of, you know, Earth Day 1970 and that sort of thing. So Carson's a really important figure in this story. And Carson, right, she wrote versions of Silent Spring in The New Yorker before the book came out. And essentially what it's arguing is that Americans need to rethink how pesticides and agricultural chemicals writ large, but specifically the insecticide DDT. She brings in herbicides in there and that sort of thing as well. She writes it in a way that's very accessible to the general public. The science of the growing science of toxicology, for example, and the role toxicity plays in landscapes and plants and animals and the concerns therein. You know, she was able to harness a language to reveal it in a way that a general public could really understand and latch onto it. And so that's the power of like the fable that she sort of constructs in the opening pages of Silent Spring. So that's part of the power of the work and the criticism that she employs in the work. She's really advocating for a larger reevaluation of humans and non-humans, right? The relationship, and it's a larger ecological whole. And so she, the interconnections between what's applied on the land and how that filters out to the streams and to the animal populations and to communities. Her book talks a lot about how we have to, as humans and as Americans, sort of rethink how this goes. Now, there's one thing that is always overlooked, and I always like to bring it up. I bring it up in the book as well, which is that although she's criticizing how chemicals have been used and the dangers sort of that she feels have been overlooked, and the science proves it out that she employs in the book, she does say that she's resisting saying that all of this needs to be made illegal or something, right? That we have to basically manage and rethink how this goes. Now, that gets overlooked in the growth of the political polarization of the period, where you sort of get into two main camps. You're either in the apply chemicals camp, like the agribusiness camp, or you're in the growing environmentalist camp. And so, interestingly, this is another route to which I inspired me to write Chemical Ends, because I started wondering, Okay, if flying 30,000 feet, so to speak, looking down at this political exchange, okay, we have these like designated camps, we have the policy debates, we have the political debates. Yes, all of that is pretty clearly defined, but it strikes me, and I wonder how clearly defined it is on the field level, right, on the ground, and within a region. And so, you know, she was very critical in Silent Spring about agricultural aviation, and she used a lot of the southern examples, the southern region as sort of, and they were good examples of the problematic nature of spraying insecticides and herbicides on landscapes without really understanding, at least her argument, not really understanding the exchanges and the relationships that come, the diverse sort of the problematic ones that come when you spray highly toxic things from the air to the ground.
Yeah. You know, so the background to this is what you call the emergence of a post-war chemical landscape or a chemical agricultural landscape. What do you mean by that, and how did it come to be?
Yeah. So what I wanted to try to understand more holistically within the region, right? So we have all of these actors on the ground trying to produce for a growing a growing group of people, a growing emphasis within production landscapes to produce as much as possible. And so in order to do that, you couldn't just rely on manual labor anymore to remove weeds or to fight insect infestations. And so, you know, DDT as the insecticide or the popular one after World War II, 2,4-D, the herbicide, like both of those become very, very popular, almost, at least they're marketed by chemical companies, almost as a silver bullet to attempt all this. And you know, the chemical companies have the World War II to sort of rely on, right? And insecticides and herbicides were used very, very effectively in World War II, and especially in terms of disease. But okay, so all of that is sort of well known at the national level. And what I wanted to do is see how pesticides, insecticides, and herbicides, how they shifted things, how they changed things within a region. So I picked the grasslands to do that. So part of what the book is trying to get at is this idea that, you know, pesticides changed things and they created new technologies, which the ag plane is one of them. They remade ideas about farming and ideas about possibilities of production, and also attitudes about health, and brought new dangers to that. So I tried to get at this. That's part of the chemical landscape, right? So the environmental part, the community-based part, the cultural attitudes part of what it comes into what a landscape is. And then part of it is who are the practitioners in all of this? So like the scientific experts versus the people actually using the stuff on the ground, or in this case, the sky. I was curious about how that fits into this larger chemical landscape. So those are some of the components about how that all looks in terms of a grasslands landscape when it comes to sort of like how is the chemicals converting this place into an image of themselves.
Yeah. I mean, to get a sense of the change, you know, pests aren't new. How had farmers, you know, tried to deal with this kind of problem before? What were their solutions before the emergence of this chemical agricultural landscape?
Well, and this is a really good point because a lot of people living in the Great Plains had a recent memories of drought and infestation of grasshoppers, you know, the drought of the 1930s, the issues around grasshopper infestations and pest infestations are fairly recent. And then a few generations before, you know, so two generations before that generation, they would still have historical memory access and through family experience and other things to remember like early 1900s problems with pests, and how they dealt with that was largely through manual labor. And so part of that is, you know, in the early chapters of Chemical Lands, I try to scope how that is and then how that changes after World War II. They devised interesting technologies to address pre-1945 issues around pest infestations, like the hoppadozer, for example, which was this basically an innovation of a plow that allowed farmers to sort of lace it with sticky insecticide and plow their fields and also try to catch grasshoppers at the same time, which they would die once they attach to the poison. So there are obviously attempts, but that's still sort of manual labor with the advent of an agricultural chemical explosion after World War II. You have not just more potent alternatives, but you have a whole technological infrastructure that's being built to deploy that more potent version after World War II.
Right. So the heart of the book is about aerial spraying, so I want to get to that. What's your argument here? How did aerial spraying develop, and how did it change things?
So Part of my focus on aerial spraying is that historically there's been a deficit of focus on that specific industry, that agricultural industry, which sort of crosses the boundaries of many different historical approaches, right? It crosses the boundaries of history of technology. It crosses the boundaries of history of science and agricultural history. So I thought in some certain respects, looking at not just the industry, but the ag plane itself and the evolution of that connects to all of these different historical lenses that then reveal new relationships within the region. So it's not just an industry history of it, but so I was curious about those sorts of pieces, how all of those pieces, the history of science, the history of health, the history of technology, all in agriculture all fit into this one thing, the ag plane. So that's part of it. So exploring that part of it also becomes, it's a manifestation of the field view approach that I'm taking in the larger book. And it goes to the argument of how these local and regional practitioners sort of carved out their own expertise and their own notions of agricultural health to try to understand the relationships that sort of are working out in the field prior to the politics and the legal infrastructure that ultimately comes into place. So, like, for example, I try to profile pilots like Don Pratt in Western Kansas, and he had all of these contracts for Western Kansas wheat. But he established and this is in his ag plane hangar, he established his own laboratory to train his own ag pilots. So if you wanted to go work for him, you had to train a week with him in terms of the aviation side, right? Because if you're going to fly, you have to kind of know how to fly. But then also, you had to train a week at basically learning the chemistry of the insecticides and the herbicides that would be deployed. He had his own test plots to show pilots how weeds grew at different stages. And oftentimes, this is in conjunction and alongside agricultural experiment station personnel and cooperative extension efforts through the local land grant, which that would be Kansas State. But throughout the Great Plains, you see that kind of highly localized efforts to try to understand all of this in a way that is very localized, very innovative. And so the ag plane becomes a manifestation, sort of represents that part too.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com. newbooks.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So it's a nexus of really the technology and the environment coming together within the plane itself. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Yes. My answer is yes to all of that. It's absolutely a nexus. And in fact, as I try to go along in the book and sort of show how the internal environment of the ag plane matters too, and how pilots are sort of adapting their early planes to sort of compensate for the problems and try to standardize is a catch term that they come up with. That's the best way to try to understand what they're doing. And then also their contribution later, the Great Plains pilots' contribution later to a much larger national standardization of aerial spraying and pesticide application, first sort of overseen in the 1950s by the USDA, and then ultimately the Environmental Protection Agency takes that over after it's established. And so what you see is, and I was excited to find this and interested to find this, you actually see a lot of the ag pilots of the Great Plains participating and shaping national policy, or at least suggestions through these government entities about sort of standardizing the process across the country. And you really do. You really also see this with the desire to standardize the ag plane itself, not just the policies around how to deploy it in the air, what you have to consider in terms of environmental conditions, in terms of region, in terms of laws that are maybe existing at the state level at that point. And so there's that part too. You have this ag engineer named aviation engineer named Frederick Weick, Fred Weick, who was in Texas at College Station, and he was part of, like, he ran around with Amelia Earhart and Charles Lindbergh, so he's sort of the aerial engineer person in that group. And he basically was charged to set up a collaborative federal project that would ultimately see what he called the Ag 1, and then he came up with an Ag 2. But these are federally funded, that are also supported by the Great Plains states, a national prototype for the agricultural spray plane, which is a fixed wing plane, and that would ultimately become sort of the standard bearer through which private companies would follow.
So there's a lot of political debate going on, right, at the national and local levels about spraying. Carson, in her book, had talked about, quote, the sinister touch of poison, unquote. So what are the problems or concerns? What are the constituencies, and what's the politics looking like that's developing at this time?
Yeah, so by the 1970s, you have pretty established constituencies. Of course, they're evolving and growing, but I would say really you have a constituency agribusiness, and to an extent, chemical companies are highly influential in these cohorts on that sort of that side, as it were. And they're arguing for an application of agricultural chemicals that offer economic, what they would term in more or less economic security. So, using pesticides is great because it keeps your crops healthy and secure. And this is some of the language that ag pilots would use, but they redefined it to fit their own needs. And that's an important sort of sub theme throughout the book, I think. But so you have sort of that group at the national level. So advocates for agribusiness saying pesticides are as safe as they can be. Here's how we're using them. Here's how we're self-regulating within the industry. And this is why we're trying to, they're sort of picking up the green revolution language of feeding the world. So that's cohort. You have a growing group on the other side, the environmentalist side, that are arguing, sort of building off of what Carson establishes in Silas Spring in 1962, and really building off of that and saying that this is dramatically dangerous in a variety of ways, and science backs this up, and we have to rethink and restrict or even stop using it. And this is where you see that shifting into making DDT illegal by 1972. Now, okay, so that's sort of like the national story. And the constituencies that have really sort of been the loudest in terms of the politics. And chemical companies are very alive and well in on the agribusiness pro-pesticide debate, if you want to call it that. But then, you know, at the ground level and the regional level, it's much more complicated. And so what you begin to see, which was a tremendous revelation to me looking through all of this and being familiar with the larger story, is that chemical companies would be publishing in their trade journals about, you know, selling strategies in terms of how to market things to different people and different groups and different industries. And they're kept reappearing in a lot of trade journals like the Journal of Agricultural Chemicals. That was a trade journal that ran during these eras, the late 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. But one thing kept coming up again and again and again, and that was they were very surprised that in the Great Plains, farmers and sometimes even ag pilots, the practitioners, they were reluctant or even refused to buy DDT, their version of DDT or insecticides, herbicides, basically agricultural chemicals, and they were very struck by this. And so they said, you know, how do we convince them? We have to change our message to fit the region, because we didn't realize that there would be people who used agricultural chemicals it would make sense that they would. We're very surprised that they're not interested in buying our product. Why is that? And so it gets much more complicated at the regional level. At least that's what I argue.
Right. And you talk about these fables through advertising. What are these chemical companies doing to work with these local farmers to appeal to them?
Right. There are two main ways that they adapted their fables, I call them, ways of sort of the stories they're telling to convince a constituency to purchase this product that they presumed would need no convincing. This is also like a revelation in terms of the historical historiography of this, because essentially it comes down to, it's easy to say that if the chemical company line repeated again and again about, you know, if some worse, the more must be better. It makes sense that you would use as much as possible, as often as possible. The historiographical sort of analysis of that has long been, oh, well, yeah, people who use it would totally endorse that. But I found a whole bunch of different examples that challenged this. The way that chemical companies, especially companies like Dow and DuPont, the way they altered the stories they told was, A, they tried to connect to agriculture and sort of a farmer agrarianism. And so they are trying to link up that way and saying, these chemicals that we produce for you are, you know, supporting your agrarian way of life, your rural communities. That was A. B, which is a really funny line. And part of the innovation of the work, I think, is that, you know, I explored all of these different conference proceedings for like the North Central Weed Control Conference, for example. And that there you had all these different constituencies, scientists, farmers, ag pilots, chemical representatives, all sort of coming together. And in these proceedings, you really see the second option that chemical companies are trying to employ. And that is, we got to tell this story by getting what they call dust on our boots. So we actually have to go out there and talk with these people, right? So this is a way of sort of shifting this message, but they realize that a personal connection and a sense of place would go long in convincing Great Plains people to buy insecticides and herbicides during this era.
Yeah, and I actually want to get back and ask you about the ag pilots themselves. Are these independent contractors? Are they working for the chemical industry? And if so, is their relationship to the chemical industry changing over time?
Yeah, I think that's a really important question, because ag pilots, if they're nothing else, they're highly individualistic. So there's this very the microculture of ag pilot sort of the industry itself, but the pilots themselves, they are highly individualistic. In fact, I would say that this is where, like, sometimes it makes sense that they would challenge regulations because they believe they're self-regulating well enough. At other times, they rejected chemical company representatives because they would argue they had a better sense of the toxicity the toxicity relationships within the ground and the air, the conditions. These chemical representatives, they didn't know what they were talking about. I mean, that's how they would see what they were doing. And then finally, to the extent they wanted to promote an image of themselves that was highly specific to expertise, sort of a practitioner expert, if you will. And so to the extent that they're collaborating at all, they're collaborating within their groups. So they would hold their own agricultural aviation society meetings, and every state has a chapter. And so they would have their own conferences and attend other conferences. But the main, I would say the main group of people they worked with to the extent that they did would be agricultural extension agents. And that makes sense because you have extension agents connecting to the local land grant, and then they're also trying to do outreach out in the communities.
Yeah. And one of the great things about this book is you connect that local regional story to the national story, but you also talk about the global dimensions. You have a chapter called Spraying Grasslands Abroad. And I want to talk about that. You know, where do these technologies and expertise and practices go? What's the outcome of that?
Well, so there are two ways to answer. One is there's a growth within grassland regions around the world. And so other farmers who farm grasslands, like in New Zealand, for example, or in Canada, are looking to the U.S. Great Plains to see both what's effective and the debates at the regional level, but also what's failing. And so what I try to do is explore how certain U.S. pilots are flying up to Canada and working with weed scientists and agricultural aviation pilots in different provinces in Canada, for example, to kind of explore that international network. And then also they would attend meetings and visit New Zealand. So I try to stay with the grassland regions. But what we also see is by the 1960s, you have an international agricultural aviation conference going on in different parts of the world annually. And so you have U.S. pilots, many of whom are from Great Plains states, attending these international meetings. And again, just like in a sort of a smaller version of that in the region with the Weed Control Conference and other conferences, you see some of the same debates. You see producers attending, you see and asking questions about their specific countries and policies. And so you see how agricultural aviation, but also this larger story about agricultural chemicals, how that's spreading abroad. And it really comes down to, I think, a general worry in different parts of the world about to what extent are chemicals shifting landscapes in their own respective countries, right? And the same sort of tensions that we see in the Great Plains and at the national story in the United States becomes duplicated in different parts of the world.
Right, right. And you end this discussion by bringing it more closer to the present with what you call the chemical digital age, which is the post-1970s grasslands. What's changed in the last few decades? What kind of safeties or risks or economic concerns have arisen more recently?
Yeah, I think the cultural response continues to be in ag aviation communities and sort of the general application of pesticides. And that is, we're standardizing, we're becoming more and more precise. So precision language is part of this discussion. The policies encourage precision and standardization as well. And so you see the, I think in the digital chemical or chemical digital age, you see that thread continuing on. You see how much digital technology is taking over human-based operations. And so very much sort of coming back around to how influential wartime technology is in terms of shaping domestic application after war. You also see drone technology really becoming a strong presence in agricultural aviation, the agricultural aviation industry. And so again, you have these sort of military non-domestic linkages. And so I think that's a continuing to evolve. And then finally, I would say that the politics around safety and risk are ever more polarizing. But also you have a lot of middle ground still. So maybe it's similar in the sense that, you know, farmers are around Nebraska in the Great Plains, they are looking at reducing chemical applications for other options, but still wanting to be beholden to the production landscape that they're a part of. And so I think, I guess what I'm trying to say is that the tensions around that and how the polarizing politics sort of overlay, that's still pretty alive and well in this chemical digital age. Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things I always like to ask when people finish a big project like this is what surprised you the most when you were working on it or what you got out of it?
I think what surprised me the most was just how complex this story is at the field level or at the regional level. I was probably like, I sort of entered in, probably like a lot of people do, you know, you've read these books on pesticides and the debates. And didn't quite realize or didn't sort of understand just how complicated and unexpected the relationships are at a more localized level. And that's definitely what surprised me. I think also, you know, that brings into something else, which is as all these trends continue on into the chemical digital age that I call it, we also are seeing a trend of more toxic alternatives. And that's going to become a problematic issue too. So you have sort of farmers right now who are saying, you know, we get that it can be problematic to use agricultural chemicals in the same way we have been using them. And maybe we need to back off because these more toxic alternatives can create more of a disaster and not less. So the risk reward for them is the risk is greater. And so that may explain some of the changes as well. But all that to say, it kind of gets back to what is an important revelation that surprised me, which is just how complex all of this is at the ground level.
Yeah. You know, David, we've taken up a lot of your time today, but I want to ask you before we go, what are you working on next?
Well, I really appreciate being here and being able to talk to you about chemical lands. My next project, so I have a second book coming out at the end of September. It's co-authored with a colleague of mine, Deborah Reed, out of the Henry Ford Museum. It's called Interpreting the Environment. It's a sort of an environmental history, public history book to help people in historic, running historic sites and museums to integrate environmental history into what they do. But my next book project after that, I want to keep broadening on some of these themes. And so I'm looking at the history of environmental risk, agricultural science, and the origins of food security in the Great Plains.
That's excellent. Sounds like a great project. David, it's been really great to talk to you, and we hope to have you back again soon.
All right. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Take care.